This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
In a world of endless notifications, there could be an important one you're missing. Your kidneys may be signaling an SOS. With high blood pressure or type 2 diabetes, your kidneys could be warning you of early signs of damage, which may put you at higher risk for events like heart attack or stroke. But there's a simple test that can help spot a hidden signal. Ask your doctor about a urine test called UACR to help detect kidney disease and heart risk early. To learn more, visit detecttheSOS.com today.
Activate a level one.
We got multiple casualties. This is a mass casualty situation here. Watt Street. They thought he had some further.
All right, there's guys. People stop transmitting. Give me a call.
WFAN. WFAN-FM. New York.
Good morning, everybody. Well, I guess those sounds from the New York City Police Department's radio communications from this past week put everything in perspective. Tuesday afternoon, October 31st, Halloween afternoon, the terrorist incident on West Street here in Lower Manhattan. Not that terribly far away from where we are physically right now either, by the way. And it gives one pause. The issue is whether or not, or exactly, I should say, what one does after that pause. Of course, this is the day that the New York City Marathon takes place. And to say there's an extra level of security surrounding that is always an understatement. But especially this year, those who seek to protect us are on alert, especially after last week's incident and, of course, the claim of responsibility coming from Islamic State or ISIS. And good morning, I'm Bob Salter. First of all, it's nice to be back with you, and my thanks to Richard Neer for covering the shift last week. I had some family business to take care of that was not pleasant, shall we say, involved death. And I was glad that things were able to be covered here. We have a busy program today in studio with us in the first portion of our show, and he'll be with us up until our update for the 6:40 time slot, is a criminal defense attorney and founder of Wagner Law Associates, which is based here in New York City. His name is Brian Wagner. Now, Brian is also a former senior prosecutor for the District Attorney's Office in Brooklyn. It's nice to have you join us.
Thank you very much, Bob.
And I should also mention the fact you're somebody who's listened to WFAN on occasion over the years, too.
Absolutely.
Welcome to the fan.
Thank you.
I guess in beginning this discussion, let me ask you for your reaction as somebody who's been on both sides of the courtroom upon hearing this. And then there's another special twist in this because you know the area where this took place very well.
Absolutely. I think my first reaction as a former prosecutor and as now a criminal defense attorney is let the facts play out and let the investigators do their job. The NYPD, this is not going to come as a surprise to you, is one of the absolute best law enforcement agencies in the world. And you hear it on that radio run, that radio between police officers, immediately they're calling for a level one. That is all units respond across all boroughs.
Right.
That's aviation, that's EMS, that's the commander for all of Manhattan South. They go into action so quickly, and they investigate, and they send their best to do that. And so that's my initial reaction when that occurs.
And when we have the talk, and you know, this comes through relatively quickly now, in the post 9/11 era, people raise the issue of, was this terrorism? Now, there were some initial reports, because there was confusion as to exactly what was taking place. Some people, if I heard this correctly, thought that this might have been some sort of a road rage incident as well. But then it seemed like just by the sheer nature of what took place, it became very apparent that this was something that was a planned terrorist act.
Yeah, the definition of terrorism is a small group of individuals or one individual that's trying to create terror to a larger group.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't have to be any religion. It doesn't have to be any location. It is just by that definition. In this case, this is an individual who is trying to send a broader terror message to a larger group. And that's what makes this terrorism. It's not his religion. It's nothing else but simply that.
When we look at the response here in New York City, one of the natural reactions is also to look at what occurred. And, you know, in a way, it seems like this was months ago, but it really wasn't. What took place in Las Vegas, which horrified people in this country. Is it fair to compare it with the response to the Vegas shootings?
I don't know if it's fair or not, but I think the question is fair. I think asking, is the Las Vegas incident also fitting within that definition of terrorism?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a fair question. Is that individual's shooting at innocent victims repeatedly, what message is he trying to send to a larger society? And that's not by any means you or I endorsing that message, by certainly not. But what we're saying is, does he have a larger message that he's trying to send other than just, I like violence? If there is a larger message, I would think it would fall under the definition of terrorism.
Now, I have to ask you, as a former prosecutor, as a criminal defense attorney, is it possible, because we often in this country will also try to, some people will try to understand the motivation of someone who's carrying out an act like this or acts like this. Is there any way to possibly understand this?
Well, you're never going to fully understand someone else, what they're thinking. And we talk about that on summations all the time. You know, what is someone's intent?
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what their intent and what their motive is, but you could use circumstantial evidence and other evidence to figure that out. Often ways, the way you do it is, what are they posting on Facebook, Instagram, social media? What are they, if they're incarcerated, what are they saying on their phone calls when they're doing that? Also going back, that little cell phone that you have in your hand, that is one of the best insights into who that person is and what he or she is thinking. And so who are they text messaging? Who are they calling? What are the conversations? Because all of that gives you an insight into who that person is, what he or she believes and what they are thinking, and also what they value. And all of those things allow you to further extrapolate and further think about what a person's motivations and intents are.
What about this use of social media by people who are conducting basically criminal activities? I mean, that doesn't seem to be one of the brightest moves of all time.
It is not. I tell my clients always do not post on social media. And as a prosecutor, I loved it when people posted on social media for that very reason. Because it's almost a bravado that, for example, if you're in a gang, you can't help but saying, look at me, I'm strong, I'm tough because I'm in a gang. And they boast about it, not realizing that when they finally get arrested for the illicit activity they're doing, the prosecutor is going to go back and look at that post on Facebook or social media or anything else and say, wait a minute, you can't deny this now. Here it is. And it's just it's mind-blowing that people insist on bragging and using that bravado, not realizing that really all they're doing is incriminating themselves.
Mm. It's amazing sometimes the way in which the mind works, especially those who are involved in criminal activity. You want to join us in our discussion? We have Brian with us for a limited amount of time this morning. Share your thoughts on what we've been talking about. You can. 877-337-6666 is our number here at The Fan. And we're talking with Brian Wagner. He's a former senior prosecutor for the district attorney's office in Brooklyn. He is a criminal defense attorney, now founder of Wagner Law Associates, which is based here in the city. When we look at the way in which and the detail that is involved in investigating an incident like this, one of the things that, you know, a layperson probably thinks is, how do you even start? Where do you know how to start?
And I think that's where NYPD and the FBI's expertise comes into play. They are incredibly trained on this sort of thing. And so what I think they do is they start at the very epicenter of the incident. They start at the truck, and they fan out from there. I read reports that they recovered some notes that the alleged person had written at the incident location. And so they read those notes. Then they look into his background. And when they look into his background, they find out who he does and doesn't associate with. And they interview those people. And if those bring up new leads, they interview the new leads. And they just let the investigation dictate what actually occurs. They don't go in with preconceived notions, and they allow it to just be an organic, natural consequence.
There's a lot of questions that I have. Hopefully some of the folks listening to us may want to join in with questions as well. 877-337-6666, talking with Brian Wagner. And we're going to talk more with you, Brian, also get into talking a little bit about some of those things that are being examined as part of the investigative process, too. Other questions as we continue this Sunday morning. It's Sunday morning on The Fan. Good morning, everybody. This is Bob Salter. We're in discussion with Brian Wagner on our program, this portion of it. Brian is a criminal defense attorney, former senior prosecutor for the district attorney's office in Brooklyn, and he is in studio with us in this portion of our program. You want to join us in our discussion? You can. WFAN's toll-free line is 877-337-6666. It's brought to you by Mohegan Sun. Unlimited possibilities await you at Mohegan Sun. Plan your stay at MohegansUn.com. You know, as we look at this case and this attack, terrorist incident in Lower Manhattan earlier this week, one of the things that I found interesting as I was preparing for this discussion today is there's a case that you had when you were working as a prosecutor that was similar to this. Can you take us through that?
Yeah. The case I had as a prosecutor, it was similar in that the motivation of the individual that conducted the attack were similar in that it's a random act of violence. In that case, a defendant mid-20s, was speaking with multiple friends that he knew, and police showed up. Mm-hmm. And although he's known these people for 20-plus years, he shoots them in the stomachs at point blank, and he runs across and he runs into a third friend, shoots that third friend in the stomach. Luckily, those three people survived, runs upstairs into an apartment building, shoots a fourth person, jumps from a balcony to another balcony. And the analogy I was making with you off air is just that they're really that sort of mental mindset. There's no real understanding except to the fact, to the extent that you just have to kind of throw up your hands and say, there is no cure for that. And you have to just analyze the facts as they present themselves.
And in doing that, you're calling on people to analyze that and to analyze it in a fashion where realistically they have to leave their emotion at the door.
Absolutely.
That's got to be tough.
Yeah. And what you try to tell people is, you're allowed to have sympathy. You should have sympathy. But your sympathy cannot dictate how you find the facts actually were. And sometimes that's the hardest part about being a juror. But that's what makes the criminal justice system that we have one of the best in the world, if not the best in the world, is that a jury full of normal people put their emotions aside and just evaluate the facts and whether or not the government has proved accusations against someone. And you hope that where people have those emotions, they are able to just look at the facts and allow the government to prove them or disprove them, and then a jury finds that without bias or sympathy.
We're talking with Brian Wagner on our program here on The Fan, this portion of it. I said what we'll do is try to work in some thoughts from some of the folks listening to us. 877-337-6666 is our phone number. Let's start with the folks on the phone here, Brian. First, we're going to – it's AJ in Hollis. AJ, good morning. Welcome to The Fan.
Well, good morning. I was just a bit confused about why the attack in Manhattan was classified as terrorist. Well, this gentleman, this attorney, said it was classified as terrorist. But yet the Las Vegas, I believe he said, maybe, because I came in tail end, I believe he said that the attack in Las Vegas, he did not feel that it was a terrorist attack. Am I correct? Did I hear it correctly?
I'm gonna let him respond to you.
AJ, thanks for calling. So what I had said is the definition of terrorism is when a individual or a small group of individuals commit an act that is intended to create terror to a larger group. And so, with this incident in New York, it seems clear based on the evidence that the NYPD and the mayor's office and other authorities and the governor's office have put forward that the intended message was to the rest of the United States and in the message of ISIS.
Now, can you pause for 1 second?
Absolutely.
Because I know where you're going. But because the terrorist in Las Vegas committed suicide, didn't he kill himself? Then we don't know what his motive was. But I believe his motive was to frighten a lot of people and scare them. But I don't understand what the difference is.
Oh, I'm not taking an opinion one way or the other whether or not the Las Vegas is an act of terrorism. I think you have a strong argument to say that it is domestic.
Do you feel that the LV attack is an act of terrorism? Yes or no?
So, unfortunately, yeah. I can't give you a yes or no. I would have to know what his message to a larger group.
Okay, this is a feeling I'm asking you, not factual. Do you feel that it's act of terrorism?
My gut is yes.
Okay, so then I must have misunderstood what you said earlier. Because it seemed earlier that you said that you thought they were different.
No, just at this point, I don't think the authorities have categorized it as domestic terrorism.
I'm not talking about authorities categorizing. I'm talking about you personally.
And that's what I was going to say. Although the authorities haven't necessarily categorized it, my general sense is that fits the definition of domestic terrorism, in my opinion.
The LV was an act of domestic terrorism, yes. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Your feeling. Okay. Yes.
Thank you for the call. Glad we can clarify that for you.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Adios.
All right. Next, we go to Ruby in Manhattan. Ruby, good morning. Thanks for holding on. Welcome to the fan.
Hi. No problem. How are you today?
Excellent. And yourself?
Good. Thanks. So my question has to do with the recent terror attack. I'm just a little confused about whether, as a terror suspect, this guy had to have his Miranda rights read, and if he didn't, what that might mean.
So that's interesting. I mean, the purpose of Miranda is whether or not statements can be used against you in the prosecution, the people, the government's case in chief, when they actually present evidence. What Miranda does not qualify for or limit is whether or not a statement can be used in cross-examination if a accused person decides to testify on their own behalf or any other limitations. So whether or not the suspect was given his Miranda rights, one, I don't know. And two, there are many iterations where that wouldn't be necessary, many times when it wouldn't be necessary or legally required. In terms of this specific case, I don't know whether or not he was or was not given his Miranda, but oftentimes statements, even when not given under or after Miranda, are still useful to the investigation because it allows prosecutors, police, FBI, and other government authorities to know the motivation and the direction in which this individual was going. So the question is a great question. Unfortunately, I just don't know the answer whether or not he was given Miranda.
Why wouldn't he have to be given those rights?
Well, because again, Miranda talks about whether or not a statement would be allowed to be used by the government in the government's case when they're actually presenting evidence to the jury. If the accused person testifies, then Miranda doesn't govern. What governs is whether or not the statement was voluntary or whether or not it was coerced, in other words, forced out of him. So Miranda is really just a mechanism for allowing the government to use the case in its own case in chief. And frankly, a lot of the times a suspect's statement is not the best evidence against him or her, and so the government might not be concerned necessarily with preserving that ability to use the statement against him or her.
Gotcha. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All righty.
Bye-bye.
877-337-6666, our number here at the fan. Folks who are listening always take us in interesting directions here. When you look at this case, look at the shooting, or shootings, I should say, in Vegas. One of the discussions that always comes up is the idea of whether or not the gun laws are tough enough. Let's start first of all with how tough are the gun laws here in New York?
So in New York City, the gun laws are some of the most strict in the country. And when I say they're the most strict in the country, in New York City, to get a carry permit, it's very, very difficult. And the jail sentences that are required by law, we're not even talking about discretion in the court, are a minimum of 3.5 years if you have a loaded weapon outside your home. Now, when it's inside your home, there's a different set of rules and a different set of laws. But the idea being that this is such a densely populated area, mm-hmm. so many people living in New York City in close quarters, that you don't necessarily want people out on the street having weapons that are not allowed to. And for that basis, the jail sentences are very high. In other parts of the country, that reasoning doesn't apply. And maybe for that reason and others, the gun laws are a little less strict.
It is also something that happens at the instance of a terror incident when people talk about the idea of punishment. Okay. And no matter what your view is on our chief executive, President Trump certainly weighed in heavily in favor of the idea of the death penalty for the suspect. Obviously, that in our country doesn't take place before somebody's actually tried and found guilty. But is that a fair discussion to take place in the country?
I think it's always a fair discussion. Where individuals come down on that, I think there are great arguments on both sides. If you're asking me personally whether or not I'm in favor of the death penalty, I've seen too many cases where the evidence is questionable, whether or not someone actually committed an act or not. And my own personal belief is if the government wrongfully put someone to death just one time, that's enough to call the entire thing into question. But on the other hand, I understand people's frustrations and people's absolute right to be up in arms about these sort of incidents. And I don't demean their discussion of the death penalty. It's just my own personal belief that I don't believe it's the appropriate sentence.
So in a case like this, if this individual is found guilty, then what do we do?
I think there is no good answer to that question, unfortunately. You know, complex questions have complex answers. In this sort of case, what do you do with that person? I think you, just like we teach our kids to try to be the bigger man, the better person, I think as a country, that is what we want to do as well, and show that we understand that people have to, that as a country, we have to be better than the next. And it's not easy. It's not something that I think everyone is going to agree with, but my own personal belief only is what I'm telling you, Mr. Bob.
And, you know, as you say that, first of all, there's all kinds of reactions from people who are listening to our discussion today, the people who are agreeing with you, the people who are shouting at their radios.
Absolutely.
pounding their fists on their radios or whatever at this time, too. But, you know, it does naturally get a reaction. It does naturally spark discussion. I mean, it's just, it's part of the reaction, especially in the post 9/11 era that we have. I mean, it's simply a fact. Brian Wagner has been very kind to be with us in studio on our program today. We've had a limited amount of time with him. He is a criminal defense attorney, a former senior prosecutor at District Attorney's Office in Brooklyn, and he has his own firm, which is Wagner Law Associates. Now, best way to reach your firm, I guess, is on the web with the website.
Absolutely.
So that's Wagner Law Associates. That's all as one word, .com. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Bob.
And certainly the best with your day today. We've got a lot more to get to on our program this Sunday morning.
Fan FM New York.
It's Sunday morning on The Fan, and good morning, everybody. This is Bob Salter. It's a busy program this morning, and we shift into a discussion about a topic that we have explored before on this program a couple of times. And it's a very timely discussion because there's an event that is taking place next week that we're going to be talking about. In the course of the discussion that we're going to have a couple of different guests join us in this chat. The first person who's online with us is a gentleman who we've spoken to before. His name is Todd Cohen. Todd is joining us to talk with us about Purple Stride, New Jersey, and talk with us about the work of the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network. First of all, Todd, it's nice to talk with you again.
Bob, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. As someone who's not typically an athlete, this is really my only chance to be on WFAN, so I'm grateful to you and to everyone there for allowing us some time to talk about this very important topic.
It is an extremely important topic. Let's do some background here. We'll get into talking about Purple Stride in New Jersey, but in talking about the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, I guess we have to begin as simply as possible. Can you describe, first of all, what's the pancreas?
Well, the pancreas is it's an organ that's located deep within the abdominal cavity. It's behind the stomach. It's in front of the spine. And it produces digestive enzymes that help the body use and store energy and also regulate blood sugar levels. So typically, people that have issues with the pancreas tend to be people who are diabetic, who have trouble with regulating their sugar. It's an organ that many people don't think about, and it's something that when something does happen to you, it could cause some major issues. My father had pancreatic cancer. He passed away in 2002, and you know, diabetes is the furthest thing from our mind. But when he was affected by this disease, you know, the pancreas became a major thing for us in our lives. He became insulin dependent. You know, that's what the pancreas is. And like I said, you typically don't think about it.
How much did he know and did you know about pancreatic cancer when he was diagnosed?
So he was diagnosed in 2001, and my father was an anatomy and physiology professor at a local community college. Mm-hmm. So he knew a lot about it, but myself and the rest of the family thought it was just another type of cancer. We knew Michael Landon had it, but other than that, you know, we were completely lost. There was not a lot of information out there for us. We reached out to several oncologists. He was treated, but like many people that are fighting this disease, he was unable to fight a valiant battle. But the information that we had was very limited back then.
Is it better now in terms of the information that's available? And also, how skeptical do we have to be about information that's online?
Well, I mean, you always have to be very, very careful. If you know somebody, and I'm going to say this pretty much throughout this, that is fighting this disease, I urge you to go to pancan.org, the organization, and that's PANCAN.org. The organization that I volunteer for is called the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, and there are a ton of resources out there. Not a lot of medical professionals are aware of the information that's out there. We have clinical trials that you might be eligible for. There's a patient-central service where patients and caregivers can give access to pancreatic cancer specialists near them. We have a survivor network where survivors can reach out to other people that are currently fighting this disease. As someone that's in the North, that's in the New Jersey affiliate, we have a number of volunteers. And I want to state the importance of early detection, and I know that's a very tricky thing with this disease because currently there is really no viable early detection. But if you can somehow catch this early, and beat this thing, you know, we urge you to help others, and that's what I'm doing after losing my father about 15 years ago.
Purple Stride, New Jersey. How do you describe what that is, Todd?
So Purple Stride, New Jersey, and Bob, you've been with us much of this way. I mean, it's been so long. The Yankees were winning World Series when we started doing this. That's how long ago this was. So Purple Stride, New Jersey is a chance for people that have been affected with this disease to come together, to wear purple, and to come out on November 12th. It's at the MacCallie Business Campus in Parsippany, and that's One Campus Drive. We have a registration starting at 7:30 a.m. At 9 a.m. is the opening ceremonies, and then we have a 5K walk and run at 9:30 a.m. As somebody that's so passionate about ending this disease, I can't say enough for people that want to come out and get information and learn about pancreatic cancer. We have the timed walk and the timed run for adults is $35. For untimed adults, it's $30, and that's the day of. But you can go to purplestride.org / New Jersey or / New Jersey and learn more about this event.
All right. Now I've got to ask the obvious question as well. Why Purple Stride?
Well, our founder, her name is Pamela Akasin Marcotte. She, and I can never pronounce her name, so I apologize, but she lost her mom to pancreatic cancer, about 20 years ago. and her mom's favorite color was purple. Mm-hmm. So she kind of started this organization in California, you know, many, many years ago, and, you know, that's the main reason why we have purple as a color. November 16th is World Pancreatic Cancer Day. So we urge everybody to wear purple. You'll see purple on news anchors. You'll see purple all over the place. You can learn more information about that by going to the website pancan.org.
And when you talk about the organization, the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, are there events throughout the year?
So this is our big event, November 16th. There's also a Purple Stride that usually occurs in April in New York City. And you can go to purplestride.org to learn more about that event as well. We kind of space them out very well. It's usually 6 months apart. And there's also an event that takes place. It's called Purple Light. It's a free event that takes place in Warren, New Jersey, at Camp Harmony, and that's on April 29th at night. It's a much more low-key kind of event where people join together and we read names of people that are fighting pancreatic cancer, and we remember those that have fought their battles against pancreatic cancer. And then every time a name is read, we crack a glow stick, and we're standing in a room that's surrounded by people in purple lights. So it's a very, very powerful event that takes place in April. So those are the two major events, and then we also have an advocacy day where we head to Washington, D.C., and we ask our local congressmen to do something about pancreatic cancer, to raise funding, to raise awareness. And then we have thousands of people throughout the country that call in to make our voices even louder. It's so important to not only raise awareness and raise money for this disease, but to let our local politicians know that pancreatic cancer has been overlooked for so many years, with a survival rate of only 9%. It's in the single digits. It's the third leading cause of cancer death in the United States. Something needs to be done to eradicate this disease.
Would you introduce Franco as well for us? He's joining us now.
Sure. Franco Jurisic is one of our symbols of hope. He's our advocacy chair, does so much for our organization, is so powerful, and I said to you, Bob, it's kind of appropriate that he's on the show today, because mm-hmm. he ran the New York City Marathon a couple of years ago to mark his five-year anniversary, and I believe he's an eight-year survivor right now, and we're so happy that he's part of our affiliate.
Franco, welcome to our discussion on The Fan.
Thank you. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Lots of thoughts come to my mind. Take us back to the time, and chronologically, when was it that you were diagnosed?
Yeah, so for my kind of adventure started in 2008. It was October, mid-October, and it was a few weeks before the New York Marathon. So I was in good shape. I was 42 years old, and the first kind of tip off that something was wrong was I noticed that my pardon me for saying my urine was getting yellow, which is, as it turns out, one of the signs is that you get jaundice. And so that's what was happening to me. At the time I thought, gee, maybe I'm just not hydrating enough. So I, you know, drank more and kind of kept an eye on things. What happened is over the next couple of weeks, I went to see one doctor and then another, and they did a series of tests. And with each result, it was like, gee, your liver's fine, thank God. Your kidneys are fine, thank God. You don't have hepatitis, you know. And with each thing, I thought, okay, that's great. Until I went on the internet and looked up, gee, you know, what could this be? And that's when I started learning about pancreatic cancer. So I was diagnosed on Halloween of 2008, and in the next month kind of learned, I took a crash course about the disease and what's involved. I was blessed to be a candidate for what's called a Whipple procedure. The tumor was in the head of my pancreas, and I was, as I mentioned, blessed to be able to have this Whipple procedure, which is where they remove the tumor and your gallbladder and a bunch of other things and kind of amazingly reconnect everything so that things can work. And I had that Whipple procedure on December 1st, and that was followed by 6 months of chemo and radiation. And I've been, thankfully, I've been good ever since. Although I did not run the marathon in 2008, since I was diagnosed just a couple of days before the event, I did sign up again the following year. And once I was done with my chemo and radiation, trained and was able to run the marathon the following year in 2009. So mine is kind of the best case scenario of what can happen. Unfortunately, like Todd, I also know the other more likely outcome, which is my dad was diagnosed 3 years after me, and he passed away just 7 weeks after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. So that is unfortunately the more typical scenario. As Todd mentioned, in the absence of some kind of screening tool, you know, something akin to a mammography, a mammogram, or a colonoscopy, folks do not realize that they have this disease often until it's too late. I guess I would stress, you know, if you're having unexplained weight loss, lower back pain, jaundice, you know, loss of appetite, things like that, get yourself checked out and be very diligent with what they're looking for in the testing, because this is a disease that doctors may not see for a while. I mean, it happens too often, but it's still considered one of the more rare cancers. It just happens that it's, you know, once you're diagnosed, the prognosis is not what we'd like it to be, and so that's what we're working hard to change.
We've only got about a minute here before we have to pause, but what does it mean for you to be a survivor?
Yeah, so that is a heavy question because, on the one hand, this is something that the same way the disease kind of happened to me, survivorship also happened to me. I was lucky that the tumor was where it was and that it manifested in the way that it did. But having been blessed, if you will, with that, I feel a responsibility. There aren't that many survivors. It's wonderful to see every day more and more. I go to events and I meet more and more survivors all the time. But there's still way too few of us. And so those of us that are around, need to kind of pick up the torch and change the course of this disease so that, my children, for instance, do not face the same kind of dim odds that their father and grandfather faced when it comes to pancreatic cancer.
Very interesting discussion that we are having. A couple of guests have joined us on our program from the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, PANCAN, that's PANCAN.org, the website that Todd had mentioned at the beginning of our discussion, Purple Stride, New Jersey, taking place next Sunday, the 12th. We'll give you detailed information and contact information on that as well. And Todd Cohen, Franco Jurisic, talking with us on our program. And we've got a lot more to get to as we share some of the story of Purple Stride and also talk about how it is that you can be supportive of those efforts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
You're jamming your favorite song, and while you aren't missing a beat, you could be missing a signal from your body. It's an SOS from your kidneys, and it doesn't sound like music at all. It's silent. High blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and other risk factors can quietly stress the kidneys, leading to negative impacts on the heart. That's why you should ask your doctor about a simple urine test called UACR. Most miss the signal for hidden kidney disease and related heart risk. You shouldn't. Visit DetectTheSOS.com today to learn more.
On the job, every minute counts. That's why Lowe's now has ProBlock Quick Dry Primer, expertly manufactured by Sherwin-Williams. Engineered for pros to dry fast and go on smooth for virtually flawless results that keep your job moving. It's available in oil and water-based, and getting it is easy. Order online by 2 p.m. and get free same-day delivery right to your job site. Lowe's, we help, you save. Orders placed after 2 p.m. will be delivered next day. Valid in select zip codes. Subject to driver availability. More terms apply.
Whatever happens today, plan to conquer it with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. True North Convenience Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. Our brew is truly perfect for any time of the day. During October and November, enter for a chance to win free coffee for a year. Check the True Rewards app for details or find the mobile app in your favorite app store. Offer valid 10/7 through 12/1. True Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.